The following presentation was recorded at the 1997 Teachers Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Worthless class I ever took. Wisdom comes easy when you're young. At 22, I knew what I wanted and what I liked. After a couple years in the Army, I knew I'd had enough of the outdoor life to last a lifetime. Others could meditate about the glories of nature. I resolved, as I duffel bagged back to college for my last 2 years at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, I would get no closer to the wilds than a golf course. Then suddenly, heading into my last semester, I discovered that I was one science course short of graduation. How about a course in ornithology? My academic advisor suggested. Insects? Birds, he answered. I understand the class is a lark. It turned out to be more like a full-scale jungle maneuver. Here's your reading list, schedule of tests and field trips, the rotund professor, Everett Myers, announced. I studied the paper, stunned. There were weekly tests, more than a dozen books to read, field trips to Ever Lake, Swamp, Slough, and Sanctuary within 100 miles. The clincher? All buses leave at 5 a.m. In the middle of the night, I wailed. We'll need miner's lamps. I found the course mind-numbing. Who, I wondered, could possibly care about a Cooper's hawk and a sharp-shinned hawk are dead ringers for each other. Professor Myers cared passionately. Who cared that a Carolina wren has a white eyebrow stripe and sings tea kettle, tea kettle, tea kettle, and an ordinary house wren has a muted eye ring and sings with a scratchy gargle? Professor Myers played a recording of its voice and tried to imitate it, falling just a thimble of Listerine flat. He'd go to any length to transfuse his love of nature to his students. Illustrating the wing beat of a mallard, he flailed his short, stubby arms like a windmill in a hurricane. To remind us that the osprey usually builds elaborate nests high in trees or on tops of poles, he hopped upon a chair and rendered its loud, squawking song, and one day, trying to portray a kingfisher diving for a catch, he folded his hands in front of his face, ran across the room, kamikazed toward the wastebasket, then did a miraculous flyby into the mating dance of a whooping crane. When Professor Myers wasn't imitating birds, he was waxing poetic about them. Their songs have inspired symphonies, their beauty sonnets, he declared, and if you watch them for only a season, study them for only a semester, they'll steal your heart away and give you a lifetime of enjoyment. Drawing on his encyclopedic knowledge, he would constantly quiz us about things we came upon while moving through the woods, marshes, and meadows. What bird uses this plant to line its nest, he would ask, pointing out a prickly thistle. Answer, a goldfish likes thistledown. Or, upon seeing a tree's bark perforated by the bill of a bird, he would want to know the name of the tree, the bird that turned it into a punch board, and what the bird was drilling for. Amazingly, I passed the course and graduated, finally packing away my bird guide and binoculars. The only good I seemed to get out of Professor Myers' course was a trove of stories about his antics, and what I joked was the most worthless class I ever took. My tales never failed to amuse friends and associates. Then time brought marriage and kids and camping trips to the outdoors I'd vowed to detour forever. With my family, I discovered a world I had missed before. Together, we learned to identify plants, insects, fossils, flowers, stars, trees, and yes, even birds. Professor Myers' lessons, cast away for years, returned like bread on the water. At a mountainside campsite, my wife Shirley, our four children, and I were entertained one evening by an acrobatic bird vacuuming insects like an airborne sweeper. It's an Acadian flycatcher, I told them, surprising even myself. The kids were impressed. And once on a hiking foray to the south, when the children were worried over a bird that seemed to be struggling along the ground with an injured wing, I explained, she's not hurt. It's a mother killdeer trying to decoy us away from her nest. Eventually, I took my field guide and binoculars out of mothballs and put them in my knapsack. In our travels around the country, I could differentiate between the scrub jays we saw in Florida and the stellar jays we came upon in California, all because of birding with Professor Myers. Trips out of the country were enriched by sightseeing of the Caracasus of the Amazon, the blue-footed boobies of the Galapagos Islands, and wading flamingos so numerous that they painted African lakes pink. However, it was daily encounter with birds at our feeder and at the edge of our woods that convinced me of my debt to Everett Myers. One day, a rufous-sided towhee showed up in the yard, and I scrambled to get my binoculars. As I focused on the beautiful tri-colored bird, it began singing in three-note trills, and suddenly I recalled Professor Myers' description of its song, "Drink your tea, drink your tea, drink your tea." And I was overcome with the urge to thank the man who prophetically said, Birds will steal your heart and give you a lifetime of enjoyment. So I called my alma mater from my home in Princeton, New Jersey, to inquire about him. He died, I learned 10 years earlier. Just before I hung up, I asked, did he have any survivors? Yes, two daughters, one in Iowa and one in Maryland. Call them, an inner voice prompted, and I did. I wish I could thank your dad, I said, but it took me a long time to appreciate him and what he taught me. So telling you is the best thing I can do. He showed me that the closer you look at the world, the more beauty and wonder you see. He helped me to understand that nature has some important things to teach us if we pay attention. One day, when I saw finches fighting over a place on my bird feeder, I squirmed to think I might resemble them vying with other commuters for a train seat. I vowed to be less finch-like. Another time, when I observed a pair of Canadian geese tending their goslings, I recalled how they mate for life, and I wondered what secrets they might share about long-run marriages if we could only read their honking. Or more to the point, how I could be more caring in my own long-run marriage. Another day, when I craned at migrating ducks flying in a cooperative V, I was reminded that helping others is the best way for all of us to achieve our common destination. And I vowed to be less self-serving and reach out a little more to those around me. Do you see it? I whispered to granddaughters Jessica and Ashley. Yes, they answered. What is it? Let me get a closer look. Then I described the little yellow bird with the reddish-brown rivulets down its chest. I'd say it's a warbler, I ventured, but we'll have to look it up. In a minute, I find a picture of a male yellow warbler in my field guide and ask the girls if they think it looks like the colorful friend in the bush. It's it exactly, exclaimed Ashley. Jessica moves closer to this sunbeam on our branch. Unfrightened, he begins to sing a one-on-one concert to her. Sweet, 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 I'm so sweet. The warm light filters through the tree, frames the two of them, a still portrait of beauty, the kind I suspect God snaps, especially for parents and grandparents. When the warbler moves on, so do we. Talking as we walk down the trail, we look for more fresh, feathered friends. Tell me, Grandpa, Ashley asked, taking my hand, how do you know so much about birds? I know very little, I answered, but most of what I do know, I owe to a college teacher. Then I tell the girls about Professor Myers and the most worthless class I ever took. Day started out rotten. I overslept and was late for work. Everything that happened at the office contributed to my nervous frenzy. By the time I reached the bus stop for my homeward trip, my stomach was one big knot. As usual, the bus was late and jammed. I had to stand in the aisle. As the lurching vehicle pulled me in all directions, my gloom deepened. Then I heard a voice, deep from up front, boom, beautiful day, isn't it? Because of the crowd, I could not see the man. But I could hear him as he continued to comment on the spring scenery, calling attention to each approaching landmark, this church, that park, the cemetery, the firehouse. Soon all the passengers were gazing out the window. The man's enthusiasm was so contagious I found myself smiling for the first time that day. We reached my stop. Maneuvering toward the door, I got a good look at our guide. Anybody want to guess who he was? Plump figure with a black beard, wearing dark glasses, and carrying a thin white cane. Life is boring if you think it's boring, and it's exciting if you think it's exciting. You're going to go through life seeing the same thing. It just depends on what you think. Now, today, we got a bigger job ahead of us than we're going to get done. Isn't that exciting? (Clears throat) is there any seat? There's a seat up here. Those of you in back, there's a chair here. There's a chair over here. There's another one here. You can go forward to these tables. Get a chair. Couldn't you, Peter, right there? Some of you have four. I think you would. It would be better if those of you that are back there would come on up and find a seat. You girls here have three. You could have another one there, couldn't you? There's room for one, two, three, four, five up here in these front. Come on up. There's still some room up here. Here's two seats right here in front. I'd encourage you to come up. Remember, don't be as reluctant as third graders. Now, all of you, I had back there, and I hope there's enough to have one of these for today. Did you pick one up that was not around the table? There's two of them, and there's some more on the table back there. Somebody that won't go get them, or pass those around. Richard, they didn't take those back. Right. I thought maybe. You need to have one of those if you can. First sheet on it says Bloom's Taxonomy. Today we want to talk about lesson plans. Now I won't ask you, so don't be too reluctant, but if I ask, how many of you here could give me three essentials of a DLP, daily lesson plan, if I ask you? How many could? Are you being overly modest? You can. Don't be overly modest. Is there enough of those? Does everybody have one? Does anybody not have one? Is there one more, Todd? Okay, we need one up here. Does everybody have one? I want to finish up some things, mention some things from yesterday. And a part of this will have to do with today. Hopefully we will take two breaks today. Around 10 o'clock I want to take one, and I want to take one around 11 o'clock. Maybe the one around 11 o'clock will be short. I'm not sure we'll get through all of this today. It would be my opinion that if you really got the message from yesterday, what it means to be a Christian teacher and the calling, and you have a feel for that, and you could do a efficient, interesting daily lesson plan, that you may have the heart of things. That doesn't mean there aren't other things to follow. By the way, if I don't talk loud enough that you can hear there in the back, just hold up your hand or holler or throw something at me or whatever. Get my attention. I want to mention, with reference to yesterday, one item, and that is staff getting along. Staff at school is a, in fact, your whole school is a mini church. And how well does it go in a church if the people, whoever that is that's running it, don't get along? How well does it go in a family if dad and mom don't get along? And I want to encourage you with all the power that I have that when you work in a school and there's more than one teacher, that you have to get along. Your testimony is dead, and every day is a drag. If you can't do that, if you can't get along with your fellow staff members, how are you going to get along with a bunch of children? That's imperative. And I know there can be difficulties. I am not ignorant of that, but they must be resolved. And I want to say this. There was a time when I taught in a school where I was a high school teacher and the junior high teacher. And I remember telling a board member, and I do not say this to my credit, I'm just telling you, I remember telling a board member that one of us is going to have to go. But to our credit, we became the best of friends. And I admit to you, I'm a little ashamed of myself that I ever said that, but I did. But you cannot teach with somebody that you cannot get along with. I do not think God will honor that. And if you are not mature enough, if you are not spiritual enough to resolve that, I really wonder if you should be teaching. I have different books here on display, and I'm not going to go through those in detail. Some of them, Howard Hendricks, about the seven laws of excellence in teaching with Carl Schaefer. If we had time, we might at some point read some out of those. They all basically will say the same thing, but they're very concise, they're very good books, and they're very true, and I would encourage you to read those. When you need something to read to put you to sleep, read one of those. Maybe they'll keep you awake longer than you think. The last thing is a closure for the day. In a way, I just quit yesterday. I didn't really close it, and that's one thing that we're going to talk about today, the necessity of closure on a lesson. Now, as we begin this, we're talking about planning now, daily planning, and we probably won't say a lot about long-term planning, but I would ask you, I think it is good, and I have talked to our staff already. When we get back Tuesday after I get home, we have another staff meeting, and I'm going to encourage them again. You have these children for 1 year. What do you expect to come out the other end? And then, how are you going to reach that expectation? Whatever it is, write down three things that you would like to see happen this year in your classroom. And then I challenge you to write down beside them how that's going to happen, because you are the key to whether it happens or not. You want the children to end the year happy? Then you're going to have to be happy, and you're going to have to think of some ways to make them happy. If you want the children to end the year with good thoughts, wanting to come back, then you're going to have to do whatever it takes to make them have good thoughts about school and want to come back, whatever it is. And it may be more definitive, like knowing their fractions or whatever. Planning. It is vital to classroom management, which we will see when we get to that section. An organized teacher and busy students are two vital ingredients for a successful school. An organized teacher and busy students. I want to read just a little bit. Did God have a plan? Blessed be the, I'm reading out of Ephesians 1. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who hath blessed us with all spiritual blessings in heavenly places in Christ, according as he has chosen us in him before the foundation of the world. Thousands of years before all of this happened, God had a plan. You read in the Gospels the life of Jesus. The Gospel of John in the 11th chapter starts Jesus' last week before the cross. You realize in the Gospel of John, from the 11th chapter on, all takes place in the week before he died and after. That much of that gospel is taken up with that small time period of Jesus' ministry. And when they heard that Lazarus was dead and Jesus was told, it sounded like he ignored them. But did he have a plan? From the first time he heard that, did he know what he was going to do? Obviously. Obviously. He knew exactly what he was going to do. They didn't. In fact, they thought he didn't even care. But he had a plan. God had a plan before the foundation of the world. God knew what he was going to do, that we should be holy and without blame before him in love. He had a plan to make us perfect before God. Do you realize that if you're a born-again believer, that in God's eyes, you're perfect? Now, the person sitting next to you might see something else, really. But in God's eyes, he says, you are perfect. That's what we are done in Christ Jesus. We are made perfect and without blame, having predestinated us unto the adoption of children by Jesus Christ to himself according to the good pleasure of his will. I'm going to jump over into the third chapter. How that by revelation he made known unto me the mystery. Many times when we think of a mystery, we think of something we don't know. But a mystery in the New Testament is something that unbelievers don't know, but we know. Hath by revelation he made known unto me the mystery, which in other ages was not made known unto the sons of men, as it is now revealed unto his holy apostles and prophets by the Spirit. And what was the mystery? This was a mystery to Israel. Way back in Genesis 12:3, God had told Abraham that in thee shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. And as clear as that message was, Israel never understood that. They always looked at Gentiles as being outsiders, no good, rejects from God. But God told Abraham, in thee shall all nations of the earth be blessed. And so what's the mystery? That the Gentiles should be fellow heirs into the same body and partakers of his promise in Christ by the gospel, whereof I was made a minister under the gift of grace of God given unto me by the effectual working of his power. To make all men see what is the fellowship of the mystery, which from the beginning of the world, God had a plan. Jesus, when he lived here on earth, had a plan. And we must have a plan too. Now, if you were going to teach in a public school, at least in California, you could not teach unless you knew how to make a daily lesson plan. That is one of the requirements. As we do this, there's always going to be some lapping of subjects. And so some things that we do and say may apply somewhere else, but I think that will be a minimum. And again, I want to repeat what I said yesterday, although that wasn't overly taken serious, I don't think. Interrupt me anytime. Have me stop if you have a question or a comment. And please stop me if I say something that's wrong. Now, there was three people volunteered yesterday, and I want to tell you right now that one thing that I'm going to want them to do with reference to today's lesson, perhaps tomorrow, I would like for them to come up here and do a 15-minute max, 10 to 15-minute lesson. And then the rest of us are going to tell you how wonderful it was. One thing teachers need to learn is criticism, to take criticism. And that, now there may be somebody who would hold up their hand if I said, is there anybody here that has difficulty with that? But most of us, if we were honest, we'd have to hold up our hand. And doing a lesson in 10 or 15 minutes is more difficult than most people think. Cal Coolidge one time was asked, if you had to give a 10-minute talk, how much notice do you want? And he said, about 2 weeks. And the man said, really? He said, if you were going to talk for an hour, how much notice do you want? And he said, I'm ready now. If you're going to say anything worthwhile in 10 minutes, you got to work at it. But anybody can ramble for an hour. And so I'm telling those three, I have your names written down in case you've forgotten who you were. I really appreciate you volunteering. Daily lesson plans. We need to, one value in this, I want to just talk briefly about the value. I feel very strong that how successful a day is at the end depends on how it starts out, and how it starts out, come on in. There should be room at a table. I know there's one chair up here. I see one back there. Maybe you don't want to split up. Is there room on that table right there for two? Come on up. There's room. Hold up your hand. Somebody that's by that chair right there, hold up your hand. Or right here, either one. Thank you. How many of you ever heard of this whole thing, this idea of a taxonomy or Bloom's taxonomy, which is what's commonly taught? Just one, two, three, four. Well, it's true, and this all has to do, now the details of it are fairly detailed, and we're going to go through some of that, and this is going to be some, there's room right up here, Glennon, if you're wanting a seat. Maybe you'll even volunteer if you get up close enough. The details of this is what they are. There are details. But I would encourage you, don't reject this. Don't think it's too difficult for me to understand. Because the essence of it and how you can apply it and improve your class presentation is not necessarily dependent on understanding all of those details and having all that in mind all the time. But the basic idea is very valid, and it is very necessary to understand it if you are going to prepare effective lessons. Children learn three ways. Everybody learns three ways. They would learn by affective domain, is the terminology that Bloom uses, and there's others now. He's the one that started this, by the way, and I'm not sure how long ago I have his books have had. I'm guessing in the 50s, 60s. Does anybody know? Would that be right? Somewhere in there, 60s maybe. Benjamin Bloom, he's the one that started this. Other people picked it up, and there's other similar things now, but he made himself famous with this approach because it was very effective. There's three ways. Effective, he calls it, that's feelings. We learn and we assimilate information into our being and remember it because of our feelings. I smashed my finger with a hammer, and I'm going to remember that because I felt it. It's amazing how children will remember one comment, maybe, that hurt their feelings. They're going to remember it because it was part of their emotional being, and it made become a part of them emotionally, and they're going to remember it. Children, everybody remembers things from the psychomotor domain. That means they did something with it. You could tell girls how to make this recipe, and they could go over it and over it and over it, and they could recite maybe a word perfect and step perfect how to make these biscuits or whatever it is. But if you ask them a month later, they had never done anything with that, they might forget. But if they made those biscuits, then they would retain it in their being. And without a doubt, I think all of us would agree, and we're going to try to demonstrate that today, at our first break that if we do something with our hands, we retain it. The more a student does with what he learns, the better he will remember it. No question about it. The main way we learn, and particularly detailed facts and what we might normally refer to as knowledge, is through the cognitive or mental process of assimilating information. And we don't want to spend a lot of time on some of this detail. I made those handouts. And we just need to look at the part that particularly affects what we need to do to prepare these lesson plans. But just remember that the more a child does with what he learns, the better he remembers it. And a corollary of that is the more he will enjoy it. Because children like to do things with their hands. And so there are these seven levels of the cognitive domain. And that's really what we want to talk about at the cognitive domain descriptions. You all have that sheet at the bottom. There is one of these sentences that you can remember. Kindergarten children almost always speak English. It's knowledge, comprehension, application, analysis, synthesis, and evaluation. Now, we want to go through this in some detail, but I don't want you to be frightened by it, saying, I'm never going to remember those seven and what they all mean. But I would challenge you to remember the essence of what they all are and that basic thought that there are different levels of learning. And unless you have thought about that and thought how to apply it, you will miss that. And the problem with that is, and if there's somebody here different, I would be glad to know it. And you wouldn't want to admit it publicly, but I'd like to talk to you. The problem with that is if you don't recognize there are different levels of learning for a child, as teachers, we automatically, naturally degenerate into the lowest level. And the reason for that is it's the easiest for both us and the student, and it takes pressure off. But it reduces learning. And so you have to put yourself a little bit at risk and enter into those higher levels if you're going to achieve maximum learning. Just because we're comfortable is no indication that things are going good. In fact, it may be an indication that they're not. You know the saying, the ship is safest in the harbor, but it isn't doing anything. And so in the lowest level, this thing of knowledge, it's just information that may either be memorized or rotely remembered. And in surveys they have taken, 80% of test questions are at this level. The student is mimicking back information he has learned. And there's some of that needs to take place. Don't think that if you could do everything at the evaluation level and you would be a super teacher. There's always some needs to take place. And what I'm encouraging you to do is when you make up tests or quizzes, or just ask questions in class, think about these levels. Am I just asking them to mimic back information? Or am I requiring them to do some thinking? Now, And they give the behavioral terms there. Define this. Define these words. They may remember what the cloaca of a chicken is, but they have no idea what it does, but they can mimic back the definition. And that's necessary to know the definition, but that might not be and is not the greatest level of learning. Describes, identifies, labels, matches, names, states. Comprehension is a higher level. And again, obviously, I just want to say this is Bloom's. You could concoct this, and you could probably have 10 levels or 5, but the idea would be the same. Comprehension, level of understanding, not memorized, student discovers relationships, intellectual skill most emphasized in school. Behavioral terms, give an example, give an analogy. Say it in other words. It requires a little more thinking. And we are going to look at some applications of this. Application, that would be most heavy in math and science. It applies rules and principles, concepts, behavioral terms, compute, demonstrate, solve, use, discover, operate, those kind of behavioral verbs, words, terms. Analysis. Analysis has to do with taking something apart. Synthesis has to do with putting it back together. And evaluation has to do with looking at the whole thing and seeing what it really means. It really answers the question, what does it matter? How many of you ever heard a student say, why do I need to learn this? I love for him to ask me that question. Because I say, what are you going to be doing in 10 years? Guess what they answer me? Don't know. I said, well, how do you know you don't need to know this thing? I mean, it's that simple, really. If you don't know what you're going to be doing in 10 years, how do you know you don't need to know this? So analysis separates into parts. It's looking at the thing in pieces. So it breaks down, diagrams, discriminates, distinguishes, outlines, relates, selects, separates. Synthesis assembles the parts to a new whole, requires a plan of operation, stresses creativity. Behavioral terms combines, composes, creates, designs, modifies, revises, writes. Evaluation, the deepest level of cognitive learning, makes a judgment of good or bad, chooses from alternatives, compares, concludes, contrasts, criticizes, describes, explains, justifies, interprets, and summarizes. Now, let's look at some examples of that. And I had about twice that many pages to hand out to you, but I decided to put the others on the overhead. The general taxonomy questions. Knowledge. Name all the characters in the novel. Write 6 facts from the chapter. You see, they could write all the characters in the novel and maybe not understand what part they played in the story, but they could name them John and Mary, Uncle George. Write 6 facts about the chapter. When does the first episode take place? Might be at the lake. Where does the short story take place? What's the setting of the whole thing? Which character appears first in this fictional selection? How does the selection end? And so on, just knowledge. Comprehension, tell me what the first chapter is about. How did the main character feel at the beginning of the selection? How did the main character feel at the end? See, now they got to think, they got to take words Then there's still a chair right up here in front, way back there, if you wanted. Now they have to take words, and in the context, they have to interpret what those words mean. And we don't have time to talk about reading, and I think somebody else is going to do that anyway. Think of the main event in the novel, and why did it happen? Explain why the chapter has the title that it does. And you can go on and on. This is just giving some examples of the kind of questions that would be asked under these. Application. Think of the situation that occurred to a person in second. Decide whether you would have done the same thing. See, I'd have to do some thinking. Would you have stolen that or whatever? Or would you have helped that person if you had been there? Give some examples of people who have had the same problems or have done the same kind of thing as a person in your story. I don't think they wouldn't have it here, but one thing I like to ask the children many times when we read stories, does any of these characters remind you of anybody in the Bible? So that gets them thinking about all those Bible stories and whether any of those would apply. Analysis. What part of the episode was the funniest or the most exciting? And then a good question to ask is why? You have to be careful, and here's under these, like analysis, what part of the episode was the funniest? You might say, well, it's when they got to the lake and started raining or something. Well, in a way, that's just knowledge, isn't it? But if you ask them why, and I've had them say in my tests, I wish you wouldn't put that why at the end. You know, it's easy to answer the question, but when you got to say why, then they got to think. Organize the chapter, number 4, into parts and think of a good subtitle for each part. That's a good thing to have them do with stories. If you were writing this story, what would you make the title of the whole story? Or if you were going to put a subtitle to this chapter or this section, what would you use? Synthesis. Rewrite the selection from an Indian's point of view. Or maybe your little sister. Just anybody. Try to think about it through somebody else's eyes and put it together in that way. Make a poster. See, now they got to take those characters and think about putting it together in a poster. How would you portray this whole story in a poster? Will children remember the story if you had them do something? That's partly psychomotor, isn't it? Now they're taking the story and they're gonna draw pictures, they're gonna do something, and they're gonna make a poster with it. Will they remember that story 20 years later? Probably will. Probably will. Evaluation. Was the main character in this novel admirable or despicable, and why? And so on. You need to do that. If you're going to teach at the highest level and the children are going to learn. Now, the side benefit of all of this, I would have 100% testimony, and again, you tell me if this is not true, the children enjoy it more. They do. Deep-seated, and in very much more deep-seated in some than others, I believe in each child is a desire to learn and a joy in finding success in learning. Now, you may have to dig a little deep in some cases. But basically, I am convinced that children like to learn. And I've wondered before, and I don't want to be too harsh about this, if there are really no dull lessons, there just might be dull teachers. And I've wondered before, after a lesson, if I wasn't one of them. Really. Now, I don't want you to go on a guilt trip if you go back home and someday you have a lesson that falls short and you think, well, I'm not destined to be a teacher. I do not think that our students and our parent clientele have a right to expect that every day at school is a thrill. I mean, that is just a little much. But I think in a week, the child ought to be able to recall something in that week that was of really prime interest to him. So if his parent said, "What'd you learn this week, Joe?" something would flash into his mind. The first of these on the next page, examples of objectives at the various levels of the taxonomy, you have that one, right? So next one. The first one has to do with the six levels, whatever they have there, with reference to a plane, closed plane curve. The next one with just Roman numerals, just giving examples of different ones with very varied subjects. Demonstrate knowledge of the Civil War period. We're not going to go through all of those. You can read those. But you do need to remember those levels of the taxonomy, and it's all encouched in that kindergarten children almost always speak English, knowledge, comprehension, application. Now, for just a little bit, and you do not have this page, what is an objective? And I want to read some of this to you. An objective. A statement describing what is to be learned and what the student will do to demonstrate that he has acquired the learning. That's what an objective is. A statement describing what is to be learned and what the student will do to demonstrate that he has learned it or acquired the learning. It's just very straightforward. Why do we have objectives? Three reasons. They give direction to both the teacher and the child. Number two, they save time because they encourage us to stay on target. Now, getting off target is called birdwalking. And all of us do that at times. And I would not say that universally, you should never get off the subject. There are times when, maybe for very short periods of time, it's okay to get off the subject. But you have to do that very, very sparingly. When I was in high school at Modesto High, we had a teacher, this was in 1948, I had a teacher who had gone through World War II, and he was a history teacher. Does anybody want to guess what we talked about, or what he talked about, and we listened? All he did was tell stories about being in World War II, day after day. And he thought he was the greatest thing there was. But when I think back on that, I realize we were cheated. It was interesting. We liked to listen because they were exciting, but we didn't learn history. And I think back on that now, and I think Mr. Gordon really didn't do his job. So you can entertain your children, and they may think it's great, but I challenge you to think about what they might think about in 10 years. They help us evaluate pupil progress for our own use as well as for parent conferencing. How do you know whether your children are doing good or bad? How do you write a behavioral objective? Well, you select a specific content to be taught. And I don't know how long your lessons are, but in 40, 50 minutes, it's better to teach one small thing and do it well than try to do too much. Somehow, as human beings, I think most people are alike. I observe this. We try to do too much in too short a time. I'm a good one for saying that in this course, but that was thrust upon me, if I can make an excuse. Don't try to do too much at one time. We have outsiders come to our devotions, and we like for them to keep it in 20 minutes. Now, when we tell somebody that our devotion is 20 minutes long and here is a father going to come and talk to the class, anybody want to guess at what the typical reaction of them is? Anybody? Just guess. Nothing will happen if you're wrong. Huh? Yeah, it's too long. That's right. They think, their typical reaction is 20 minutes. I can't talk for 20 minutes. But they do what Richard said. And they go half an hour. I would say 90% of them, they get started talking and they just talk and talk. And as teachers, we can do the same thing. You need to severely restrict the lesson for each day. And if you have this objective written down, it'll help you do that. So you select the specific content to be taught. And the key word there is specific. Select, and then number two, you select a perceivable behavior for the learner that is directly related to the content. You've got to select a behavior. Number three, you combine the content and the behavior into a statement of purpose. And we'll look at some of these. Example, the learner will circle all nouns in a given paragraph. The content is the nouns. The behavior is the circling. These are very simple, but it's to give you the idea. The learner will sequence the number cards from 1 to 10. The content, numerals from 1 to 10, the behavior is sequencing. And on and on. Now, in most curricula today, and this was not true up until, I'm guessing, maybe 20 years ago. In most curricula today, the publisher has done the meat of the work for the teacher. If you pick up almost all publishers today, whether they're secular or Christian, they in their teacher's manual will have done a lot of the lesson planning. Some of them, maybe not the daily lesson as much as a weekly or a section, you know, with objectives and the whole thing in it. But some of them are very detailed. Now, that is good in one way, in that it helps you know what the publisher had in mind. And if I wanted, I don't have Becca's, the teacher's manual. They might have it here. I didn't bring mine. But they have a whole other section. This is just the student text. They have a whole other section about that big in the front of it. That's all teacher information. And it's a lot of the lesson planning done. Now that's good in one way, and then it gives you a basis to start. But don't rely on that completely, because what part of the problem is those aren't yours, and you're not familiar with them, so you don't associate with them. You don't have a passion for them because you didn't write them. And don't look at those as gospel. Take those and modify them. That's what I do. I don't follow their plan, but I use it as a basis, and it helps me a lot, and then I modify it to suit me and the class and the time that we have you know, the whole scheme. Everybody's situation is different. If you're in an individualized, and I thought about copying these off, but I didn't. There's so much copying to do. This is out of Christian Life. Here's a whole page out of a Bible Light unit, and here's the objectives. They're all listed. And so as a teacher, here's another page out of another one. No, this is just a continuation of that. There's 19 of them given in here, objectives. Now, they won't all necessarily be behavioral in that they are evaluatable, if that's a word. But they do have objectives, even in the individualized curriculum, in each PACE or light unit or whatever life pack, whatever you use, and for each section. And so the publishers today have done a lot with that because they know in the public school that the teacher is required to prepare daily lesson plans. And so if they have done a lot of the work for them and done a good job, it is a real selling point for their material. And I'm sure you must realize this is not as true in the Christian world, but in the secular world, printing textbooks is a multi-billion dollar business. It's a big deal. So they're not doing that because they're wanting to help you. They're doing that because they want to sell the textbook. But it is a big help. And don't neglect making the most out of that. The other thing probably that I should say, maybe before we get into writing some of these objectives, is that as you become more and more familiar to teach, you may need these to be less detailed. Now, in my original course with this, I have it for each day, I have it all written out exactly what to do. I did not do that with this one. I did not take the time to do that with this one, although I used that basic scheme. And I used a plan book. There's all kinds of plan books, daily planner, like this. I'm sure you're familiar with them, and you can take these, whatever it is. This is Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And so in my original, the six-week course that I used for this, where I have about twice as much stuff, for every day, I use this. So what I'm going to do for an anticipatory set, all the way across here, what I'm going to do, I use that for the whole day. I have it all written out in detail. Well, that's pretty comforting to open this thing up. And what am I going to do today? Well, right here it is. And you're going to do a better job. It puts you at ease. And I know that if I get this done today, that was a successful day. I've done it. One value in having a goal is that when you reach it, you know the goal is done. If you don't have a goal, how do you ever know when your goal is done? You know, it's like that list that I mentioned you with the children and their mother. You know, if they get the list done, it just gets longer. They're never done. The danger in that is, and I remember a professor that I had in college. It was a dynamics course at the university. I took from this guy, and he was a tremendous professor. He would write on the blackboard, and it looked like a machine. This guy was organized. His notes were beautifully done, and he was a great teacher. The last day, never forget this. The last day of class, he had these pile of notes that he had used for this course in dynamics. He had put them together personally. The last day of class, before he walked out of the room, he took those notes and threw them. Hard as he could. And his point was that if he taught that class again, if he was going to teach it with the same intimacy, with the same passion, he wanted to redo them all again. Now, I've never done that. I just don't. But he has a point. You see the point? You can just rest on what you've done before, and you lose that feeling for it unless you go back and rehash that and redo it. And don't rely too much on past. That's what he did. He redid it every time he did that course. Redid the whole thing. Start all over. But you must be organized. If you're going to be successful in the day, you must know what you're going to do that day. Now then, we're going to take a break. What I want us to do, and this is awkward, this is not the best situation, but I want to do it anyway because it's going to teach us something that I want to impress on us. And because of the time, I'm going to do it a little bit backwards. And there's this many of us. If we most of us were doing this in our schools, we would have 15 or 20. But what I want to do is I want to take a break, and in 10 minutes, I want us to assemble over in the little gym. And if you don't know where that is, follow somebody that does. It's over here somewhere. And we'll do the best we can with what we're going to do. I need a boy that is familiar. One of you boys know where the tractor shed is? Down beside where they park the pickup. Anybody? You know, Glenn? Down there in that tractor shed, if you raise that door, there is a dog kennel thing there, and it has an animal in it. Now, you can bring the whole thing, or you can just bring the animal. Okay? And so at 10 after 10, and there will be a small break after this thing. At 10 after 10, we will see you in the little gym. Yes? No. Is bullets or seeds. You can offer your ideas to others as bullets or as seeds. You can shoot them or sow them, hit people in the head with them or plant them in their hearts. Ideas used as bullets will kill inspiration and neutralize motivation. Used as seeds, they will take root, grow, and become a reality in the life in which they are planted. The only risk is in the seed approach. Once it grows and becomes part of those in whom it is planted, you will probably get no credit for originating the idea. But if you're willing to do without the credit, you'll reap a rich harvest. Now, I could have described the chicken to you and described the gizzard and the heart and what all those things do. And you would have learned something about a chicken if you didn't know anything about a chicken. Or maybe even if you knew something about a chicken, you still might have learned something that you didn't know. Or I could have, on an overhead, showed you a chicken and discussed all those parts with you. And if I would have taken this to some place that could have even been done in color, this is out of a better biology book, could have even been done in color to make it more interesting, And we could talk about all those parts of a chicken. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on that, but I'll just ask you, would you learn more about a chicken the first way or this way, or going and seeing a chicken and cutting it up? And the answer, I think, is a combination, right? We could have spent time in talking about a chicken and showing you the picture, so when you got there, you would have known, and that's more what we would do in a biology class. But would anybody deny that the most learning takes place when you do something with what you know? Now, we want to write some of these, and it's going to take some feedback from some of you in order to write some of these. And I know there are a lot of you here, but don't be too bashful. And this one thing before we do that. Now, it's fairly simple what I did. But all of you as teachers, I hope you recognize that that takes some extra work. You know, I have to get a chicken. I have to have Ivan get it, or you can have a student get it. That's usually what I do. It gives them something to do, makes them part of it. Joshua, could you get me a chicken? I know his family has chickens and their neighbors have chickens. And he is delighted to be a part of it and get a chicken. You have to get the stuff together. If you're going to put them in little bags, you have to get the little bags. And you say, well, it's a small thing. Yeah, it's all a small thing. But it takes extra work. And again, I submit to you, the easiest thing to do is to present your lesson at the lowest level of learning. It's easiest to grade. It's easiest to present. It's easiest for the student. It's easiest for everybody. So why not do it? Well, that's not where learning takes place. It's just the way it is. Let's look at some of these. And you don't have this sheet, I don't think. Kindergarten children, so it's knowledge. So it's red, black, and it doesn't show. Kindergarten, that's knowledge. Children, it's comprehension. Always is application. And what's the next one?
Analysis.
And the next one is synthesis. The last one is evaluation. Now again, I'm not saying that you're going to be less than what you ought to be as a teacher if you don't memorize those. But you ought to remember the concept and apply it. If to some extent, to the greater extent that you apply this, the better your teaching is going to be. Can you all see this halfway? You can't see it over there. Well, what can I do so you can see it? Move it over to the middle more.
most Heisman candidate. So, normally in a class, I would issue these and I would have the students do this. Pick a subject, write a goal objective, then write a behavioral objective at each level of the taxonomy. The example is given in parentheses. The subject, the one in parentheses, is growth of America, the history lesson. Somebody pick one. Anybody? Pick a subject. Nobody has a subject.
Grammar?
Huh?
Grammar. English grammar.
Oh, grammar. So what level are we talking about?
Fifth grade.
Okay. Grammar. Good.
It's a little hard to write on. It's not very dark, is it? What's this pen say? That's a whiteboard mark.
Grammar. Fifth grade. Okay, what might be a goal of grammar in the fifth grade? Maybe you can just follow me as I write this down. What might be a goal, objective about grammar in the fifth grade?
Proper punctuation.
What?
Proper punctuation.
Proper punctuation. Possibly even confine it to commas or end punctuation. Or two of them, or something, right? Let's just say commas, since there's more uses for commas than anything else. Comma, punctuation. And what are we wanting them to be able to do? Comma punctuation. Know how to use, or just use, three types of commas. How about that? That's your goal for today. You're going to talk about commas. We're just going to talk about three uses of commas. There are, anybody know how many there are? I think there's like 11. Seven, a lot of uses for commas. Maybe three, four, five of them are very common, more common than the others. So what might be a knowledge behavioral objective at the knowledge level? Anybody? Surely, somebody. Yes? The three rules and such. Recite or whatever. Name, state, write. Recite the three rules. Sorry, that doesn't show better. For another day, I'll try to get a better pen.
I think
I actually
want a black.
You think?
I used to. Black.
Oh, somebody switched them. That's the book red. Okay.
There's one or two of them. If you keep it right, it's right. But I see.
Maybe it's just red. Okay. Comprehension. What might be under comprehension? First, they're going to be able to recite these three rules. What might be under comprehension? Anybody? Yes.
Using an example.
That might be application, using it in a sentence, correct? Comprehension might be why are the commas important? Comma, does it matter what the commas are? The importance. This is working very well. importance of puns. And then, use them, right? The three sentences each or whatever. Write the three sentences each for the rules. How about analysis? What would you do with analysis?
Study incorrect uses.
Sure. Look at some. That's very good. Look at some incorrect uses. What they might do. Study would be a better word. Incorrect uses. Now, let me say that brings up. There are some lessons that do not apply very well to all of these. You know, so you may not be able to use six steps in each one you were doing. There are some lessons that will maybe it's not today. Some of them lend themselves to it much easier than others. You have to skip one of these and not dig in. But the concept is there. The concept is there. Synthesis. Anybody?
Would this include using it now in your writing?
Sure, so what might you do?
Write a paragraph that I mean, use the correct comments.
Use all three rules.
Yeah.
Or a sentence. Use all three rules. Write a sentence. Or a paragraph. Using all three. You aware that when Paul wrote Ephesians, there's some of the longest sentences in the Bible, Ephesians. I mean, he has colons, and commas, and semicolons, and you name it, and some of those sentences just go on and on and on and on. So he must have done some grammar, although I realize he wasn't writing it the way we're reading it, but there must be some similarity between it. Evaluation. Anybody?
Would that be contrasting with how you didn't use the pun?
Sure could. Contrast with no pun. Or misuse, right? Of pun.
See, the concept is fairly simple, isn't it? But the application, you can see, gets a little bit sticky. And it takes practice to do it. But I can assure you that the more you do it, the better you will get at it, and it will soon become automatic. I think that is the important thing that you realize. For instance, I was either in the third or fourth grade. Isn't it amazing what you remember in third or fourth grade? I went to school with some people that live right around us. In fact, we had a double wedding with a girl that I went to school with. And we get a bunch of old classmates together. And it's amazing what we all remember. One of them will remember one thing, and I remember something else, and they'll say, "Do you remember the time you?" And I say, "No, I don't remember that at all." I remember it was third grade, and my teacher, Mrs. York, used this example with comms. I never forgot it. I don't know why it stuck in my mind. She probably told me a lot of other things that was more important. But I remember her writing this sentence. This man was going to buy something for his boss, and he wrote the boss back
and telegrammed him how much it was going to cost. And the man wrote back, the boss wrote back, and he says, no price too high. So the man bought it. But he meant to have a pop on here. That's something how you remember that. Right, that is fixed in my mind about commas. They've torn the schoolhouse down now, but it was still there. I can show you where I was sitting when she told us that. Just a little example of commas, and I always remembered it. Let's look at another one.
We're not going to do the top part per se because of the time.
In the top part, in a regular class, we would have them write in order the 6 degrees of the taxonomy here. And then beside each one, write a word, write some of those words, get used to using those words. And I would encourage you to do that. Write a question that requires the use of that thinking, and then write the question. So you're writing down the taxonomy, you're writing here on this line some of the words. So let's just look at some of these. What I want to do instead of that is just look at some and see, have you tell me. And I'm doing this for two reasons. One, I want you to see the experience of it. And the other part is I want you to see that it is not cut and dry. One person may look at an objective and say, well, that's comprehension. And another may say, well, that's evaluation. Or whatever, analysis. I mean, it's not easy. But still, I want to hammer home the idea that the concept is there. I mean, if you write an objective, and you wrote it to be an application, and somebody else said, well, it's not application, it's analysis. What does it matter? It's still a good objective. You see what I'm saying? And you had it in your mind that you was writing something beyond the knowledge level. I hope I'll probably say that again. I'd like to say it, and not that you would get tired of me saying it. It may have helped you remember. Given a ruler to measure the room, find how long the room is. What is it? Huh?
Application.
Application, probably. Somebody knows how to use a ruler. What is the Sixth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution?
Knowledge.
Not asking them what it means, not asking why it was there, just saying what is it. Rewrite Psalms 23 in your own words. Synthesis, wouldn't it? I think most of us would agree to synthesis. Compare the Sermon on the Mount with Paul's epistles. Huh? Evaluation, probably. Anybody want to say something else? List all the characters in Genesis. Knowledge. Just making a list. Most of these have one of those key words back in there on it. But what I hope you're seeing is that listing all the characters in Genesis, while that's important, it may be important, and it's good that they know them, but that just because they could list them would not really mean they'd learned very much. Isn't that true? So I hope that in your mind you're thinking how you could write another objective that would indicate that they learned something, or it would motivate them to dig a little deeper. What are all the events that led to the discovery of America? Now, there's a good one. What's your answer now?
Synthesis. Comprehension.
That could be a whole bunch of them, couldn't it? Because if you're going to list all the events, then you're going to have to do some reading and some digging. I mean, you can't just say, the ocean was there, everyone was going across it. Identify and write a question for each level of the taxonomy. Anybody? Yes.
Can you tilt that down a little bit?
Oh, sure. Like this? A question. I'm
keeping it too high for you. I'm looking at this instead of up there. Identify and write a question for each level of the taxonomy.
Seem like it. Yeah. Somebody could say, well, there's knowledge involved, but you got to list them. And then you gotta write one. So there could be several in one objective. Sometimes just by adding the question why at the end changes the level immensely.
Given a list of numerals with answers with no operational sign, the student will determine what the operation is. See, like analysis. The student will make a choice between two ways to solve a problem and then explain his choice. Seems like the evaluation. Given a story to read, the learner will draw conclusions from the information in the story.
Okay, let's try one more. I'd like to keep on this just a little bit.
And then we're going to move on.
Well,
while I'm doing that and getting those out, why don't you start the song?
Sing it. Stand up while we're doing it. Right.
There is a mother at school that I doubt the week goes by when she brings her children. She does bounce in the room and tell me she's praying for them.
This article, can you all read that article?
I'll go ahead and read it because I realize it's really hard for some of you. Most women sew out of necessity and they do an adequate job. There are a few, however, who are amateur professionals. These women are really artists, seamstresses par excellence. Dorcas of the New Testament was such a sewer of the cloth, and she was noted for her durable and beautiful garments. Such women of our day have electronic machines that use special threads. They also have access to many pre-designed patterns. In spite of all these excellent aids, professional sewing requires patience, diligence, creativity, coordination, and hard work. Few seamstresses reach the status of master. This was a story in a book, and you were going to have your children do something with it. What might you ask them to do at the knowledge level?
Seamstress.
Just knowledge level. What else might you do at the knowledge level?
Come on, there's a lot of you here. You aren't that tongue-tied, are you? Or maybe you are.
What benefits do modern seamstresses have?
What level would that be at?
Could be, but with knowledge, you could say, you could ask, what skills or what virtues or what characteristics are there of a master seamstress? You could list those: diligence, creativity, patience. How about comprehension? Anybody have a comprehension one? This comes to my head. How about having them watch their mother sew? See if they can see all those virtues of life. That's not saying that themselves doing something, but they would be doing something with what they were learning. Analysis? Anybody?
When they're watching their mother, they figure out if she's a master.
Sure. Well, why does it take all of those? You know, why is this so complicated? Synthesis.
So different.
That might be one thing. I'm going to go ahead and try. Even a simple thing. See if it doesn't take all of that. I've never tried it, and I'm not about to. What's that do? But I'd do about anything. So, evaluation. What might you do for evaluation?
Or are there more master teachers?
You could
master sewers.
Or master sewers. You could make an analogy. What other skills are there that your mother does or that your father does that would take similar things? You know, until you've tried something, you think it's easy. A brother at our fellowship, at a meeting we had just 10 days ago, at a men's meeting, he said, "Why don't we have a library?"
I mean, all you got to do is get some books, isn't it? Put them on the shelf. "Well, I've had a little experience with the library." I said,
"You do not know what you're saying. That is a lot of work. And the only way you know that is to try it." And isn't that the way with most things? Have you ever noticed, I don't know how it is in your circles, have you ever noticed, though, how socially even there's a few parents organize and have the parties and the social events and the other people discuss. And I've talked to some of those people. Well, it's no big deal, is it? Well, obviously you don't know, you never know. I mean, just having a simple young folks get together takes some work. Nothing in this life that is worthwhile happens by accident. It doesn't matter if you're teaching, it doesn't matter if you're raising a family, or you're on the job. It takes work, and it takes organization. And the only way you know that is to try it. I have a nephew who is a gung-ho guy. I mean, he would tackle anything, whether he knew anything about it or not, and probably be successful. He's that kind of a boy, young man. And he always said, Uncle Ed, sometime when you need to be gone, I'd like substitute over there for you. And so one day, I let him. No, I think it was 3 days. And when I got back, he couldn't believe it. He said, I am tireder at the end of the day than I am if I go out and work hard. He said, I can't believe how tiring this is. Well, I don't go around telling people how terrible the job is and how hard the job is, but isn't that true? I mean, I can go out, and I've done it in summertime working for a farmer. I can go out and sit on the tractor for 15 hours and just enjoy myself. I can think about all kinds of things. When I get home from school, I am worn out. I don't want to answer the phone. I don't want Barbara to say anything to me for an hour. I just want to be left alone. Seriously. I want to get a glass of iced tea and just walk around. I'm tired. My spirit is shot. Now that sounds like it's a terrible job, and I don't like it, but I do. I love it. But that doesn't mean that I'm not tired. But you only know that if you've tried it. You only know that if you've experienced it. Go down where Ruby's working in the library and tell her that that's a simple job. Why aren't you done? No, don't tell Ruby that. That wouldn't be wise. Here's another way of looking at this, and then we're going to put this all together before we end today. Basic guides for more effective practice. The three M's, it has to have meaning, it has to be modeled, and it has to be monitored. And you read out of these, the teaching changes lives, and the excellence in teaching with the seven laws. Basically, all these schemes for learning. The SQ3R, is that right? Is that what it is? And all, you know, there's all kinds of those acronyms. Basically, they're going to cover the same thing. You have to teach something that has meaning to the student. You have to do it in terms that they understand. The student has to want to learn. And you need to monitor and make sure that it's learned. You know, just simple terms. A learner understands what he is learning and why he is learning it. And again, that might be difficult with some students and in certain situations. Relate to the learner's own life and experiences. One time, a boy came up to me, and in the light unit, he was supposed to describe a topographical scene. And this boy was non-academic minus. Really, nice boy, hard-working boy, but that was all he did not understand or anything what he was supposed to do. He was a freshman in high school. And I knew that he went hunting every fall with his father, and he loved to hunt. And I said, Ryan, I'll tell you what you do. When you go hunting with your father, and you get to where you're going, and you step outside the pickup, you describe for me what you see. Oh, is that what they want me to do? I said, yeah. I mean,
misspelled words, incomplete sentences, but he did a beautiful job of describing, and that's what they're talking about, a topographical scene. He had a great time doing it, and misspelled words didn't bother him a bit. But it was a good article, really. I mean, it was very graphic. And I'll pay a writer that has some creativity and can't spell and doesn't know how to complete sentences any day over a writer that knows all the words and how to spell and how to punctuate a sentence. And it's boring as all get out. It is easier to instill and teach a child grammar and spelling than it is creativity. Do you know how to teach somebody creativity? Do you know, Brendan? I don't either. That is difficult, isn't it? So just because somebody can't spell and all this, write along. Model it. Explain the whole and the part relationship. Why you're learning this is part. And particularly in math, why do I need to know fractions? Well, you might have a wife someday that doesn't know, when she's doing a recipe, she doesn't know how to take two-thirds or a half a cup of something or whatever. And all kinds of things that you can relate to them. Establish relevance wherever possible. Modeling. The teacher has to demonstrate the correct procedure. Remember that the first exposure sets the cement. You need to do it in very concise terms, and if we had more time, we would do some lessons. Maybe we'll see how time goes, and we might do one. I look in a test, and the student incorrectly answered this question that seems very simple to me. It may be, who was the first king of Israel? And they put down David. A very typical thing. And I think, now that boy or girl, they know better than that. You know, they have read those Bible stories. They know better than that. I'll pick up their light unit, and I'll go back in the light unit, and guess what I find? Anybody?
Now they are answering the question the whole time.
That's the way they answered it, that way in the text. They answered it that way on the self-test and then corrected it. But the first thing a person learns about something is what sticks in his mind, even if it's wrong. You know that? I think that is an important concept. That's why I do not like these false questions. There's other reasons why I don't like them, but the primary reason is I don't want a child to read something false. If you're not careful, that's what sticks in their mind, the false statement. Without fail, when I've gone back and looked, that's exactly what happened. They answered it wrong twice before, and they got to the test, and they answered it the same way. They corrected it, but that didn't register. What registered was that first wrong answer. And I think we're all somewhat that way. Remember that modeling is a powerful psychological tool. It doesn't matter what it is. You all remember in 81, 82, whenever it was, Mount St. Helens went off in the state of Washington, and 3 or 4 years later we took the whole high school up there on a 3-day field trip. We had a fantastic time. But and that was several years ago, 10 years ago. Any student that went on that field trip, if I ask them what they remember about Mount St. Helens, I can virtually guarantee you what they'll say. We had a guide where you stood and the Forest Service guide explained to you what went on. I mean, this guy got in there and this mountain blew up like that, and then all of this ash come down and wiped all those trees off of that and scooped that lake out and sent it up that mountain and then come rushing back, and he went through that whole thing. I mean, no student stood there, spelled out. I did too. That guy was fantastic. And that's all they talked about the rest of the trip. I didn't even finish yet. I mean, he had them into it, and they'll never forget that presentation. It's a powerful psychological tool. Monitoring. You've got to know what goes on. Check to see that work is done correctly, just working for the individual child. You need to ask yourself these questions. How much of a learning task should be practiced at one time? Smallest part is still maintained, maximum meaning. Don't have children do too many things at one time. They'll get all mixed up. You know, sometimes, as teachers, we think, well, they ought to be able to remember this. And that is one of the values I see in a student, in a teacher, taking classes, whether it's here, particularly where you're tested, or at a local college, or whatever. You need to put yourself back in that student mode. And you find out you have the same fears they do. You make the same mistakes they do. Well, I know he told me these five steps, but all at once number three escaped me. Isn't that true? I mean, we are, that's the way I am. And that is a good experience for any teacher to be in, to be reminded. You need to be told time and time again, patiently and lovingly. In a way, we never get out of the children mode. And that's true of me. I've already said that all the time. I act too much like a kid. I hope I never quit. So we do have our differences. How long should practice periods be? Short, intense, with a great deal of student effort. It's been said correctly that 15-20 minutes, a lesson ought to be varied. You ought to do something. Sing a song, read a story. I'm here, we're extending it. And in your classroom, you need to wake people up every once in a while. There's different ways of doing that. I can tell you how a preacher did it one time. We was in the congregation, and this preacher was preaching away, and I guess he thought some people were going to sleep, and so he's preaching away, and he goes, "Hark, hark!" Everybody woke up. And he said, "Now that I got your attention, I'll continue." There's all kinds of ways. I mean, I have already, if too many aren't paying attention, you can bang a book on a table and wake them up. Yes? Is that okay? That's, by the way, that monitoring, checking to see the work's done correctly, is one real negative, I think, of individualized curriculum. And it can be a better too, but the temptation is to not do as much checking as you should do. Not even think of sliding. I don't know if any of you ever let things slide. How often should you practice? For new learning, practice should be masked, should be done right away. How often? I think as much as how often is right away. The sooner you do something with what you've learned, the better you're going to remember. To establish learning, practice should be distributed. How well? By specific knowledge results, by immediate knowledge of results. Testing, quizzes. There is a term that anxiety is a great motivation to learn. Anxiety
is a great motivation to learn. And what is meant by that is if the students know that they're going to have a quiz, that brings a certain amount of anxiety. If they're not sure, but they might have a quiz, that's even greater anxiety. And that is a tremendous motivation to study. Don't forget that. A lot of times they ask me, are we going to have a quiz today?
And I'll say, you come to class and find out. Now, you don't have to have one every day, see, because you get to study three times with one quiz. They don't know. You see what I'm saying? If they know that you only have quizzes on Wednesday, that reduces the anxiety. And you think about that with reference to you going to school. You took a class in college and you knew that, this guy Springs quizzes, you're going to do more. That's just the way life is.
You're going to do more. Think. We could go on and on with this. There is all kinds of things, but what I want to do now is look at the overall lesson design.
Is this dragging too much? Am I going too fast, too slow? Anytime I would, seriously, I have this fear that none of you are going to tell me anything, but I would appreciate knowing what you're thinking. And I can take criticism. Just smile. So let's look at an overall lesson. What should an overall lesson have in it? Well, it needs to have an anticipatory set. The children, they come into class and they're still playing ball. You know, Johnny got thrown out at second base. He comes into math class or history class or whatever class it is. Is he thinking about history and math? No, he's thinking about getting thrown out of second base. And if you don't get his mind on what you're doing, halfway into the class, he's still thinking about getting thrown out of second base. Well, that doesn't run a little faster or whatever. And so you've got to do something to get their attention. The other benefit of this, and I don't know what all you do with tardiness, and that's part of what I'm doing here in reading. I don't know if you enjoy the reading or not, but it's kind of an anticipatory set. It's kind of getting you to forget your breakfast and start thinking about, this is class. So I'm getting your attention. And it can be as simple as reading. I have all kinds of reading, short stories, poems, all kinds of things. It's not hard to get children's attention. In a Sunday school class, I tend to bring all kinds of things, and I many times bring them in a brown paper bag, and as soon as I bring a brown paper bag in class, I can see them all talking about, trying to guess what's in the bag. I've got their attention with just a brown paper bag. And one time I didn't have anything. but I had their attention. Looking at the brown paper bag. Usually it's something that's relevant and they associate with or they enjoy. It may even be such a thing as just a quick review of something of yesterday. Something they're familiar with. You need to have an objective. What are you expecting them to learn today? And as simple as that sounds, how many of you have ever taken a class from a teacher and you really wasn't real sure what you learned that day? Kind of a little bit scatterbrained. Wasn't sure. The purpose. Some statement as to how this is going to benefit them. If nothing else, it'll help you do the quiz tomorrow, if you'll listen to what I'm saying right now. The purpose. You know, it could be something as straightforward as that. Input, modeling, you got to always be doing that, trying to get feedback. I would spend more time in my classes in getting feedback out of you. And they know I'm going to give them points for participation. They know that. That's a motivation for them to participate. I ask for volunteers. They'll volunteer. An expert teacher one time told me, you don't look at your class and say, this is a detail. But you think about the implications of it. You say, Mary, what is? Because as soon as you say Mary, nobody else is listening. You're not going to call on me, you're calling on Mary. But if you state the question and then look around and then say, Mary, would you answer that? There's a whole different scheme of things going through the other student's mind just by putting the name being instead of the beginning. Isn't that amazing? I never even thought of that until he told me. Check for understanding. Guided practice. Work completed under the teacher's supervision. After you have explained how to add unlike fractions, then you put a problem on the board and you have them answer it while you're helping them, going through it, and that gives them a through that kind of thing. Guided practice. Closure. Articulate the learning, summarize, do the learning again, and then issue the homework. It needs to be very, very definitive. There can never be any doubt about what the homework is. I have parents call me and say, William says he doesn't know what the homework is. He doesn't think that you gave him any homework. And I need to be able to say, I had that written out on a piece of paper, and I specifically gave him a copy. He may have lost it, but he had it. That needs to be very definitive. Now, this closure thing, I want to talk about just a little bit. Closure.
You need to know when the lesson is ended, and the student needs to know when the lesson is ended. And I did not do, for instance, a real good job of that yesterday with a reference.
See, at the end of the day, I could have said, this whole session had to do, if you don't love children, you don't feel a calling from God, then you shouldn't be. You can do closure in 15 seconds, 30 seconds. Sometimes you look at all the steps and you think, boy, that is awful complicated.
Some of those can be done very, very quickly. The anticipatory set, you might do that in anywhere from a minute to 5 minutes. And I don't know if you have student role takers or not, but you can do that kind of thing while your student that takes role, takes role. And so don't look at all of these, and you know the context of how big, how much time you have to do a lesson. We basically have 50-minute periods to do lessons.
Now, I wish I knew. I know we have gone through this fairly fast. I wish I knew what you were thinking. This has all gone a little bit faster even than I thought it would. And we're obviously going to get out of here on time. I knew that. Because that's my thing. These are a couple. I just want to look at a couple of these. This is a form that I use, and you can. There's all kinds of forms. Make it to suit you. What is the class? Writing and grammar. Lesson number 8. The objective: watch an animal and record what it does using 5 or more action verbs. You can have bring pets. Do you ever have your students bring pets to school? Oh, you're laughing. You got to limit it or you will end up with a pet shop. They love to bring their pets to school. That's no problem getting them at all. It might be a problem getting home. But have a student bring their pet. Now, who are you going to pick to bring their pet?
I would be surprised if any of you that teach, you don't have children that have a greater difficulty. Let's just take this subject here of writing and grammar. That doesn't have trouble with that, and it's not really interesting to them. Don't have the student that does real good at that bring their pet. That's something you can have the child that has a bad attitude about writing and grammar. And at least for one day, they're going to be excited about writing and grammar because they brought their cat.
It's easy for us to always center and give the privilege to the good. There's another side to that, I know. But we really need to be careful about that. That's one thing that aggravated the Pharisees. Jesus paid attention to the people that were down and out. I think about the camel. So you can, in a writing or grammar, you can do such a thing as just bring an animal. So what do you need? You always need to think about what you need. See, before I do that chicken, you know, I need a towel, I need to make sure that if something happens that I can mop it up. I need to have those bags, I need to have something to fasten the bags. I need to have a garbage can to put it all in. I mean, you need to think about all that you need. You need to be organized. You're never going to anticipate ever emergency. But it is unforgivable to not anticipate those things that aren't really emergencies. Activity in groups, see who can think of the most verbs. And I don't know, later on we will talk about cooperative learning, but you can do this in a cooperative learning way. You can have them go into groups, and then you can mix the groups up, and you could end up with a total. Public schools do a lot of that. How many of you do any cooperative learning things where they do things in groups, and then you put two groups together, instead of having 6 groups, now you've got 3 groups, and then you put them together, and you end up with a sentence. You do that. That works great with poetry. We've had great fun. How many of you have done that? You got to control it, but it works. And children like it. They can change their attitude about many things. But you have to really monitor. You can't just put them in groups and go out of the room. But I just want to encourage you, don't assume too much. Guest speaker, I put that on there. We have all kinds. You don't have to do that a lot. Obviously, you're not going to do that with every lesson. In each class, you might do it once or twice a year. Wouldn't have to be a speaker about writing and grammar. It could be a speaker about animals, like the local dairy, whatever. We've had parents come, bring a horse. Now, if the children know that right after lunch, some father's going to bring the horse, anybody would want to guess what they talk about at lunch? I mean, that excites them. Just, I mean, they see horses. What is there about that? The children love animals. And when they know a horse is going to come, they're going to get a pet horse and maybe even ride it. I mean, they are out there. They are excited. Even teens. Now, some of them are a little more young to show it, but if you suggest that they go in the classroom, you find out what they really think. All kinds of books. So the lesson, that's sort of the layout, the lesson. You're going to do 5-10 minutes. It could be 2 or 3. It doesn't have to be 5 or 10. I'm going to read a story out of the children's Bible, and it's going to involve animals. Maybe Daniel in the lion's den. It doesn't matter. Did you ever wonder if they don't get tired of Daniel in the lion's den? Or whatever Bible story? And then I thought one time, you know, there's a limit to that, isn't there? But you know what? I thought about that one time, and I'm 63 years old, and I don't get tired of it. I still like to read. And maybe too. There's something about those stories you don't get tired of. I never get tired of reading about David and Goliath. I mean, that is such a fantastic story, the whole thing, that I just love reading. And they could do. Modeling. Think about an animal or have one. Describe it by using action verbs. Depending on what you had, you could have a chicken. And you could do all kinds of things with it. Those of you that were down there earlier, one Glenn brought in it, it was crow. Here it comes. But I'll tell you right away, it wasn't the hen. How many of your children would not know that? I think sometimes we forget how far we are removed from the farm. I had a mother, 40 years old. I was shocked. And she one day, she said, I know this sounds dumb, but does all the milk we get in the store come from God? Seriously. And I was shocked. She said, I would do. But just hadn't really thought about it. That kind of opened my eyes. You know, because I grew up on a farm, and it's easy for us as adults, as parents, teachers, or whatever, to assume that everybody knows everything we know. I mean, what's so hard about that? I know it. People don't know everything. Children only know what they've been told or they've observed. So you read a story. Modeling, you can have an animal there if you wanted to. And we're doing all this with birds. Birds? Yeah, birds. Guided practice. Each of them describe the actions of an animal. Either the one you have or some other animal. Then walk around and check their birds. Independent practice. Have them ask their parents. For 5 more verbs. Never pass up an opportunity to include parents. I'd love to have children ask their parents. What does that tell me? I am killing 2 birds with 1 stone. For one thing, I'm finding out how involved parents are in their children's education. And that can be depressing, but at least it's information. They'll ask me a question at school, and I may or may not know the answer. And I'll say, young man, I'll give you 5 points on your next test. You'll talk to your dad about that and write down what he says. Anytime that I can get them to talk to their parents, I'm going to do it. Because there is a danger in us as teachers in replacing parent role. And I'm very sensitive to that. There is danger in the children respecting me more than they do their father. There is danger in them asking me things that they should be asking their father. So anytime I can throw that back the other way, I'm going to do it. Here's one on algebra. Algebra 2. Arrange a quadratic equation in standard form, identify and list term coefficients in order. We could do that lesson, but we're not going to. That's the objective. I want them to be able to take any quadratic equation, put it in standard form. That's what we're going to talk about today. That's what they're going to learn today. Now, the thing is how are they going to learn? You don't need any special equipment unless you maybe had a set or used an overhead, which we don't routinely in class. Activities, class participation. I'm going to model this thing, and then I'm going to have them come to the blackboard and do some while I'm watching. They are going to participate. Unless they're used to that, our students reluctant to come to the blackboard and expose their ignorance?
Yeah.
If I ask any of you right now to come to the blackboard, the whiteboard, and do something, would you be reluctant?
No.
If I were sitting there, would I be reluctant?
Yeah. I mean, that's human nature.
And we have to get them out of that mode if we're going to help them learn. So the set, I'm going to just review the problem. Some unique problems that may puzzle them. There's no middle term in this one, so some of them may think that is the quadratic, but it isn't the middle term that makes it a quadratic, so we're going to talk about that today. I may bring all kinds of things in just a set. It doesn't have to be a funny story. I'm going to discuss and review set, and I'm going to work some problems. Very orderly. Now, think about this. I mentioned to you that professor that I had, and when he wrote on the blackboard, it was like a machine. That forever impressed me. Just that one thing about that man changed my life. Because I saw that, and I saw how it affected me, and I determined to do that. When I write on the board, I try not to get into every word. Try to print very neat. Try to do it very, very nice, because I know that professor impressed me when he did that. And there, you're not going to impress anybody by sloppy writing on the blackboard or anywhere else for that matter. Does it take longer? No. Not once you practice that. When I went to college, I got very sloppy. That man convinced me that that was no excuse for that. And I decided to turn that around. So you're going to do some problems. Guided practice. You're going to have them work some problems on a certain page. While they're doing that, you're going to walk around the room and see what they're doing. Is there a certain amount of anxiety with them and you walking around the room? Yeah. I mean, they'll try to. They don't let anybody see what they're doing. Amazing what they do. But you need to do that. You need to monitor and see what they're doing, and that's when you can help them. Independent practice, and you're going to assign some problems. Simple as that. But it all centers around that one thing. What was I doing that day? I wanted them to be able to arrange any quadratic equation standard form and identify term coefficients. Very definitive, direct. One day's work. Turn that light on, is it back there? I wasn't sure that we would get that far today, and maybe I should have given more time for questions, but we have 12 minutes. And so if anybody has any comments, and I would hope that some of you do, would you make them, please? I don't know, but I assume you associate with all of this. Anybody have any comments or questions? What was that?
What if someone mentioned a very creative story and you never heard of it?
That's a good question. What did somebody do? I don't know what I do, but what does somebody do? Yes. Oh, the question. A student hands in a very creative story, but you know the parent helped them with it more than maybe they should have. Is that implied? You suspect that at least? What would you do? Anybody?
We're going to call the parent and talk to them and see what really happened.
Yeah, that's the first thing I'd do is call the parent. That is a little bit, I mean, you can't say you can't talk to your parents, can you? You don't even want to say that. So I try to give them some guidelines, and I do not have them here, about what they can do. But the idea needs to be theirs. And to me, there's a big difference between them having the idea and then their mother writing it, or dad, or uncle, or bigger sister, or whoever. But I don't mind if they wrote it, if somebody else edited it. Now you say, how much editing can take place? And there's where you can't just draw a line and say, well, they can't add more than 10 words in any one place, or, you know, I mean, you just can't do that. But I think they have to have some guidelines to where the thoughts are theirs and the idea is theirs. And I would limit the editing to grammatical primarily. Now, if they wrote this article and their mother said, well, I think you should have another paragraph in there between these two, I think that's fine. And then they write the paragraph. But you do need to be careful about that. But the first thing I do is call the parent and then see exactly what took place. Does that answer your question? What do you do? Anybody else? Yes.
Do you have any suggestions on what is a good schedule for doing these lesson plans?
Oh, good point. I do them primarily a semester at a time. I like to know I know what I'm going to do this semester. You can do them for a whole year. You can do them for a week ahead, but the year is busy enough. I like to know pretty much what I'm going to do a semester at a time, so that frees me from that during the year. But I would say you need to find whatever level you're comfortable with reference to that. Anybody have any comments on that? Yes.
I have a question. We use the vector lesson plan. As a student, it's also like there is a student to square per subject per day. And I know in my school, I'm teaching from 6th to 12th grade English, plus I'm teaching some science, I'm teaching some and biology. I don't have all that room. My lesson plan, but in that little square, cover everything I want to cover today. You said you just wrote all the way across.
Except I have another teacher will come in and do a business writing with the high school 3 days a week. So we have a combination.
I guess my question would be, I felt like when I did my lesson plans last year, I didn't have a good enough grasp of what I was doing. But I couldn't teach the student. I mean, all I had on there, basically all the room you have is there, is what page numbers you're going to cover that day, what you're going to give them for homework.
maybe you'd be able to stick in something real small.
Mm-hmm.
Something special you can do in class.
Well, I don't want to be facetious, but it seems to me like the answer to that problem is very simple. Throw that bug away and get another one.
So you're just saying just use it up as it comes?
Well, yeah. I mean, you can get all kinds of books, you know. I don't like to be crowded for space. I'd rather leave some spaces blank than, you know. I don't know. Am I understanding what you're saying?
Yeah, you're understanding.
Yeah.
I'm saying, you know, we just order one per teacher at the beginning of the year, and that's what we had.
Mm-hmm.
I felt kind of cramped.
Mm-hmm. Well. I think a book like this is $5 or something. $2.95. Anybody else? Todd, you had something to say?
If you wanted to put an outline or something on a piece of paper and just Xerox up a bunch of things, you can just put it as three.
You can make your own planner just by doing these things. You know, I just designed these last two things I showed you. I just designed them myself. And this isn't all fixed in concrete. I mean, adapt it to your needs, your desires, your goals. But don't let children only learn at the knowledge level. Yes?
If you're teaching, let's say, 4 or 5 grades, uh-huh. all the subjects,
uh-huh.
Especially a couple of years, where do you think it's necessary, like, to do an exact lesson plan of fifth grade English when you know exactly what's in the lesson? It looks a little overwhelming, to me at least, to do 15 classes a day or whatever I teach. To do an exact lesson plan in those kind of subjects, like math and English, where you've taught for a number of years.
If you read the books that the experts on this, they would all recognize that an experienced teacher can bypass a lot of this if he does it knowingly and knows what he's doing, and it can be done very effectively. I'm not saying that every experienced teacher has to write all this detail for every day. And I don't think anybody would say that. I'm glad you asked that question. I don't. For some classes, I do, depending on what I'm doing. Yes?
How important is different levels learning in various grades? It seems like you have to build on it.
Good point. Absolutely. That's right. I'm glad you... I'm glad you mentioned that. Mm-hmm. Obviously. You all heard her question. Do all of these levels of learning in the taxonomy necessarily apply to all grade levels? Obviously, at the lower grades, you're going to be more into knowledge, and you're going to build on those as you build forward. I'm glad you mentioned that. Good point. Anything else?
Comment on your anticipatory set.
Mm-hmm.
I've found that very effective. The students really enjoy that, appreciate it, having something, just a whole story or something.
Mm-hmm.
Just to get started with. Found that very effective.
Oh, I have. I learned that from somebody else, and it works. Yes?
Are you suggesting doing that like 2 or 3 times a day? You're like, after breaks, after activities?
Yeah.
Each time?
Yeah, you would not, you don't have to do it necessarily every class every day, but particularly when the children come in out of PE, after lunch.
Yeah.
Yes.
Where do you find
your
material?
What? Oh. No. Hey, there are books, you know, these books, there's short stories, there's poems, everything. I'm always, anytime, I'm just picking up stuff all the time, stories and little anecdotes and things in the newspaper. I don't take the newspaper, but I buy it a couple times a week, just little articles. I mean, there's as many things to do with that. I mean, it's a wide open door. It's a matter of keeping your eyes and ears open. Maybe a comment I hear in a grocery store. Sets up a train of thought. Whatever. I mean, all you have to do
We got 1 minute, huh?
All you have to do is say, you know, I was in the grocery store last night and I heard, and they're all listening. Because it's a real story.
People like real stories. Lord, our Heavenly Father, we thank you for the morning. We pray your blessing on it. We pray that each one of us here has honored you by the day. We really do need your help and your blessing. Help each one of us to feel your love in our hearts. Because in a very real way, we're just little children. So we thank you for everything you do for us. And we look forward to seeing you in that kingdom to come. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.